Thank you very much, Joyce. I must say it's, I want to thank you and everybody who helped organize this symposium, which I think is a really good idea. I didn't know until this morning that it was called the Maver Moore Cultural Policy Symposium. Maver and I had a little exchange at York University. Tried to get me, tried to stop my getting tenure at York University. And he lost. I got tenure and then I resigned. So that. However, I have to admit that despite the differences we had along the way, he was never part of anything at the Canada Council, by the way, as long as I was there, or Peter Dwyer. But he was actually an excellent chairman for the Canada Council. He was able to talk in a avuncular way to folks at Rotary clubs and in the arts, and I think did a wonderful job there. And I liked his book, by the way. I wish he'd gone up to contemporary times rather than stopping where he did. 1974. What were the prevailing conditions? Social, cultural, financial, political. Well, they were about the same as they were in 1954 when Metro Toronto was formed as a municipal government. Back when it was formed, I was attending Earl Haig Collegiate Institute, one of five high schools I managed to go through in the course of my early education. And we crossed, I used to cross the fields up there where they were building the 401. Metropolitan Toronto, a little bit like Scarborough College, was thought of as sort of an oxymoron. I actually like Toronto a lot because I came from Moose Jaw, and the contrast is actually quite substantial. The municipal government in Moose Jaw once passed a bylaw establishing one-way sidewalks for pedestrians, which I thought was pretty ambitious of them. Didn't work out too well. And my father told me, he was a United Church minister in Moose Jaw, he told me that at one of the city council meetings, there was a plan to try and enhance the waterway. The Moose Jaw Creek ran down through the center of town along River Street, oddly enough, and there was a suggestion they should buy a dozen gondolas to sort of ply up and down the waterway. And the debate went on because it was quite an expensive undertaking. And one of the city fathers finally put up his hand and said, he thought, why didn't they just buy a pair and let nature take its course? So, at Hart House in the early 60s, at a debate on the city of Toronto and its future, Alan Jarvis, former director of the National Gallery, said, not when, but if I die, I'd like to die in Toronto. Because the difference between here and where I'm going will be imperceptible. He also described Yonge Street as 10 miles of shithouses leaning against Eaton's. It wasn't not a bad description for our major artery. So I don't think town planning's actually been our forte. But I would say that by 1974, there were certain indications that things were perking up in the wake of the centennial and Expo. The country generally got a kind of a lift. And in Toronto in particular, with David Crombie, whom I knew at Earl Haig Collegiate, we used to smoke. We were in grade 12 together, I guess. And we used to smoke in the back of a 1952 Meteor at lunchtimes, which explains why he's as short as he is, and I used to be. So, Bill Kilbourne, who'd moved into Toronto from Dundas, Ontario, moving from McMaster to York University, and became an alderman, a dynamic person who was largely responsible for me getting involved, and Carl Jaffrey, whom I'd known at Victoria College at the University of Toronto, had worked for him in the Drama Society and some other activities there. And Carl had actually written a report on the cultural policies for City of Toronto at the year before. Joyce has touched on some of the credentials I already brought to it. I'd started the Toronto Outdoor Art Exhibition with Murray Koffler. I've been at the Canada Council as what Ian Baxter referred to as an art official. And I'd been at York University. I was at York University at the time. So I did the report. I offered to do it for, I've forgotten what the fee was. I said something like $2,500. They said, we can't pay that. That's not possible. But our maximum is $55 a day for a consultant. And I remember this because I said, but let's come out about the same. And he said, no, it doesn't matter. We have to do it by the day. So I actually billed by the day. I think I billed maybe $3,000 or something like that in the end. I would say that the report didn't exactly fall, the seeds of the ideas in the report didn't fall on fertile soil uniformly. There was good support from Paul Godfrey, without a question, and there were people in the city of Toronto particularly who were positive, and a couple of others from Scarborough, Etobicoke, and North York. But you had this unusual arrangement with the with five boroughs and the city in those days. So the five boroughs, Etobicoke, North York, East York, York, Scarborough, all ganging up on the city of Toronto, which felt besieged by its suburban neighbors. They didn't want to pay for certain things in the core, and there was always a great deal of tension. When there wasn't opposition, there was tension. There were egos and resentments that flowed back and forth between them. There were doubts and fears about the direction things were going. There was bullying and vendettas, the usual kinds of things you expect in the political sphere and in human life. I talked to everybody that I could. I think I actually did get around and talk to all the aldermen, all the mayors, and to their assistants, and to the reporters at City Hall, because you know they were the ones that were actually going to write the thing up and try to get them on side. I think what I was trying to do was to get those who were supportive to be positive about things, and for those who had no time for any kind of cultural initiative, and there were quite a number of them, was at least to get them neutral, or at least not opposed to something going ahead. You'd say, you know, Paul Godfrey wants this to happen, so, you know, don't stand in the way, or, I mean, much more subtly than that, but still, I think that was a thing to do. And I had the advantage, I think, of being a minister's son. My father, in his role as a minister, taught me, or I guess I just learned by watching his example, could talk to anybody about anything. You know, it didn't matter whether they were at the top of the social chain or the financial world or all the way down at the bottom. All social classes, all manner of individuals were to be treated with respect, and I think that certainly helped. Mel Lastman was always a bit of a holdout. He thought the whole report was all crap, and Paul Godfrey would sort of nod and let things go. But I do remember an interesting thing when we were trying to put through a Metropolitan Toronto grant, a capital grant to support the building of what is now Roy Thompson Hall. I was pushing. I thought it would be coming up at the meeting, you know, 2 weeks from now. Paul said, no, we wait. It'll be the meeting after that. I'm sending Mel Lastman to a conference in Winnipeg because he knew he'd be voting against it. And Paul had very carefully counted all the votes for this. And he was astute about these things. And I thought it was kind of interesting that he did think that way. So how did it work then? The report was adopted. They did not accept my suggestion that there be a Metropolitan Council, Advisory Council on the Arts, which I was really disappointed in that because I liked the idea of having an equivalent to the Ontario Arts Council and to the Canada Council, sort of adjacent to central government. But that didn't happen. It hasn't, has never happened, I guess. Although we, you now, with the new regime of a few years back, have sort of come to grips with it. So I was the first director of cultural affairs. I had a secretary, or shared one with John Kruger, who was the chief administrative officer, and I was attached to his office. I think this is very helpful, to be attached to the top administrator. And it certainly helped time and time and time again. Whenever I appeared at City Hall, especially in front of council, I always wore a blue suit and a conservative tie. It's not what I usually wear, but it's important to wear the uniform, I think, in certain instances. I don't think I actually used a wonderful tool I used at York University when I used to go and see the assistant or the vice principal of finance, and I at a critical moment when we were discussing how much the faculty should be getting, I whipped out a slide rule and went, you know, and said, you know, we can't live with this number of FTEs. We need full-time equivalents. We need this much more. I didn't know how to work a slide rule, but he was impressed, and I managed to get the win the day. I learned that if you have one budget line, you should press to get two budget lines, so that in fact, in the process, you expand the overall amount of money that you get. And if you've got two budget lines, you should consolidate to one budget line, because in the process, you'll try and get a little more money by arguing that that you get a clearer picture of what, how the allocation is actually made. I think it's very important we extracted the big four, the symphony, the art gallery, the opera, and the ballet, from all the others, because they were simply sucking up all the money. So to try and set them aside and make some divisions that would help people see things separately and in different light. I think that the biggest success of that policy actually occurred with respect to the O'Keeffe Center. And I was taught, Metro had become the owner of the O'Keeffe Center, and it was a really sore point with the boroughs particularly. And they were all annoyed that the opera and the ballet seemed to occupy it for half the year, and they weren't paying what was considered to be fair market rents. So I came up with, I thought it was a good idea. It actually did come through talking to John Kruger about it. Charge them fair market rents, but then Metro would have the privilege of giving them the money, and they would look as if they were being very generous to the opera and the ballet at the same time as they were solving the problem at the O'Keeffe Center. And that actually worked, and it was quite clear to the mayors of the major municipalities that this is how we're going to do it, simply because it changed the optics for them and for their constituencies, and was a good solution. I had hoped the same thing would work out for Roy Thompson Hall and the Symphony Orchestra, but the administration of the hall didn't see things quite that way, I don't think. I also found it was necessary to have what I guess in the confines of this room I would call hush money. It was small amounts of money out of the budget that you simply had to allocate in order to obtain certain votes. This is the realpolitik. I'll cite an example. Dennis Flynn, mayor of Etobicoke, said, "If you don't give something to the Etobicoke Orchestra, I'm going to vote against the whole package. It's that simple." So the Etobicoke Orchestra wasn't exactly competing with the Toronto Symphony at the time, but in terms of its quality and its number of concerts. But something was possible. You know, it was $2,000 or $3,000, enough to buy them sheet music and to acknowledge their existence. And that happened in a few instances, very few indeed, I'm happy to say. But sometimes that is necessary. I think I also had some problems fighting off Caravana, which I thought should be a tourism expenditure, not a cultural expenditure. But, you know, we debated that and found some solution which didn't bite too largely into the cultural budget. And I think it might be a measure of the confidence that we were able to develop in the process of writing up the submissions for the consideration of the council, that we had a first grants went to Robert de Rosier before he was supported by either the province or the federal government. Same for Tafel Music. Same for the play Tamara, which went on to a great acclaim in Los Angeles and elsewhere, and to the Festival of Festivals, which has grown into the greatest, one of the great film festivals of the world. I don't know if Danny, I see Danny Grossman sitting there. I don't think we're the first people to give you support, but we were there for sure. I made a couple of errors along the way. At one point, I thought it would be really easy to try to simplify things for politicians. I said, look, it'd be easy. Just all we need is a dollar per capita. And I think the population was about 2 million at the time, so that's what we're aiming for, and we'll get there over a period of 3 years. That turned out actually to be a straitjacket, not so much a target, because when we got there, now they want to put the lid on, say, well, a dollar per capita is enough. No, and I was saying, well, no, but the budget has to continue to grow somewhat. So a percentage of the budget would have been a smarter way of going at it. And it took a while to undo the enthusiasm that I developed for the dollar per capita, I must say. Not easy. And I also had to convince a number of aldermen that the artists, not all artists for sure, are kooks and weirdos. You know, there's always that simplistic kind of mythology that swirls around. And I told the story of actually going in on a Canada Council jury with Ken Lockheed and Yves Gaucher. One day we were in Saskatoon, we went and paid a sort of courtesy call to Mayor Buchwald, Sid Buchwald, wonderful man, later a senator. And I thought it would be maybe 5 minutes just to say hello, the Canada Council is here. We're delighted to be in Saskatoon. This is Ken Lockheed, who hails from Regina, and Yves Gaucher from Montreal. Great painters and so on. Well, we were there at least a half an hour or more. We talked about wheat. We talked about the weather. We talked about football. We talked about a lot of things. And then we got up and left. And just as I was going out the door, the last one, going out behind Ken and Yves, Buchwald grabbed me by the sleeve and sort of pulled me back into his office, and he said, you know what? He said, that's the first time I met artists and you couldn't tell. So I would remind the aldermen and the mayors around the Metro Council table that most artists were hardworking people, intelligent people who were making a significant contribution and deserved their support. To the extent, the largest extent they could. I suspect the principles that I thought I was following at the time probably still obtain today. Culture, to me, is like parks or transportation or sports or recreation or education. It's something that should be supported by all levels of government, and it deserves to be dealt with in a professional way. Tourism, I guess. And it's a responsibility for all levels of government. If governments are dealing with the constituency they have, then culture has got to be part of it. And there are lots of statistical ways of proving that. Proving that, in fact, it's a big part of our lives. I also used unashamedly the leverage that I said I could get from the province and the federal government. And I did go and pay calls on the Ontario Arts Council and the Canada Council and to the ministry and department responsible for cultural affairs to try and get more money into Metro and to help them in the process of getting more money into their coffers generally, so a little more could flow toward toward Toronto and the activities here. I made a big thing. I guess the third thing I would say is I always made a point that the cultural activities of the city were in fact part of its profile and absolutely essential to its sense of itself and its sense that other people might have of it. I believe that all taxes should address all the needs of all the citizens, and I believe that that is... I still fret at the fact that the municipal level of government doesn't have the taxing power that I think it should have, and it has proved to be so beneficial in other cities around the world. The I've mentioned already the proportion of the budget that should be targeted and safeguarded, even in difficult times. I think it's always easy for politicians to put what they, a lot of them still consider to be frivolous activities up against educational bedrock issues. But I think getting a proportion of the budget always is an important thing to try to get. I've been on record in the past talking about the arm's length policy. A lot of people use the phrase quite casually, it seems to me. I believe two things. One, that the total amount allocated to culture is a responsibility of politicians, and they should be held responsible for it. You can't get away from the fact that their job is to allocate the resources. And if we have to gang up on them, then we have to do it. But the allocation of it, once the total amount is available, is something that should be done by knowledgeable people. And I often use the example of we're basically next door neighbors, and there's a fence between us, and you cut the grass on your side, and we'll cut the grass on our side. But the fact that we are interdependent is very important, and I think it's the most important thing is not to let the political class step aside from its responsibilities. The other thing that is not accepted very easily by politicians or the public generally, I think, it may be because the media encourages us all to think that way, is there's never been there never seems to be any allowance for failure. In the area of science, for example, or research and development, there's always an allowance for failure. And this came home very, very sharply to me one year when Leon Major was running the Toronto Arts Productions over at St. Lawrence Centre, and he got less than he was hoping to get in the budget cut, and he phoned up and said, you know, what? Why didn't I? I said, I'll come over and visit you. We'll have a chat about it. So I went over to his place to have a talk about it, and I said, you know, there are these new theaters have come on, Toronto Free Theater, the Tarragon, Factory Theater Lab, and some other activities, and, you know, they've got to get some support too, so, you know, there's only so much money, and we try to allocate it as fairly as we can. And he said, well, I accept that. Well, now I think I've got him going. I go a little step further. And then I said, stupid me, said, and of course, Leon, you know, your season last year wasn't all that great, really, when it comes right down, right? Big. He took his cigar out of his mouth, and he said, wait a minute. Do you think that we actually set off to do something that didn't work out and be a great hit? Do you think that we actually set out to make something mediocre? And I realize, of course, that no artist sets off to do something insignificant or piddly or indifferent. They set off to do something wonderful, great, and it doesn't always work out that way. Scientists can spend 4 years in a lab making one mistake after another, after another, after another, looking for something, not finding it. Everybody seems to think that's all right, but in the arts, we expect nothing but the best every time out. So I learned that, and it was a great lesson for me. I think that politicians also need personal education. It's important to deal with them personally, feed them information. Sometimes they're not open to it, but nevertheless, it's an important thing to do. And I guess I would also say that the battle, and this is one of the faults, I think, of the cultural community at large, we imagine that at some point, if we can vanquish the Philistines, once and for all, we'll have won. Let me tell you, the battle never ends, because the Philistines are always there, and it's a continuing battle. It is because human nature is the way it is. There are people who are always going to be opposed to or indifferent to or nasty about the aspirations that those of us in the cultural community have for our society as a whole. Notwithstanding all that, it's amazing what wonderful things have happened in Toronto in the interim, from the great Carabana celebration to the Toronto International Festival, Nuit Blanche now doing some wonderful thing, the Authors Festival, the Art Fair. There's some really quite wonderful things that have been happening. Conclusion, I would say that every generation invents its own style and pattern of how things should be done. But actually, they really reinvent. I think I realized this at some point when I thought we were starting from scratch and doing things that had never been done before. And then maybe I just mellowed a little bit, but I began to realize that actually quite a lot had been done before. I just didn't want to look at it, and we wanted to do something new. So there's nothing wrong with inventing new ways of coming at it, even if there are old patterns. Sometimes you can certainly learn from the past, but the important thing is to find the energy to make things feel as if they are new and fresh and on the cusp of something major. We also have been through a period from beginning, actually, in the 1970s, was the beginning of a period of sustained growth in the arts. It's major. I mean, the prosperity that we've enjoyed in the last several decades is unparalleled. I was down for the Governor General's Book Awards announcement, the shortlist announcement earlier this week. 1,400 books were nominated for consideration. That's in Canada. It was hard. You could count the number of books published by Canadian authors in Canada in the 50s on the fingers of both hands. It's absolutely amazing what has happened. And I think a lot of this has happened because of the media attention that's been garnered over the last two or three decades. There's in the business I'm in now with collecting in the visual arts, there's what I call the Antiques Roadshow Syndrome. Everybody is excited about collecting and trotting out whatever they can find in the attic to see if it's worth $1 million. But there's excitement about that. Their major collectors have developed, emerged. Corporations have been collecting art. The art market has gotten very strong. The internet has provided a kind of knowledge base and an area, a place where people can find out more quickly about, get information about things in the arts. We all have a great deal more mobility, and of course there's been population growth, not insignificant. But that whole, we've been living in a wonderful, I hate to call it a bubble, but in fact it is. I mean, my generation is a generation that has not been involved in war and has had unparalleled prosperity. It's a great and wonderful thing. And I don't think we should waste it or throw it away. but it's going to, difficult times are coming, I suspect. I used to tell the alderman that I had a theory about addiction, and that is that some people, like Paul Godfrey, for example, would sit and watch baseball for hours and hours and hours, game after game after game, hoping for about 15 or 30 seconds of absolutely great play. I knew people would go to the National Ballet, and they'd watch hours and hours and hours of dance, hoping to see one great performance, or just something that was electrifying and moving. And my wife is in the theater business. She will go to a lot of productions, just hoping to find one a great moment. Actually, we hit several in a row this past week. We saw Hamlet in Stratford, The Music Man, and then the opera War and Peace. I got to tell you, amazing productions all. But and in my case, I'll look at 1,000 paintings in order to see one that just gives me a real thrill. And I said, you know, there are people like that. And I always try to find out what each alderman or mayor, what their passion was and what they were interested in, and explain that, you know, there were parallel things in the arts that they had to pay attention to. And also remind them that everything begins with individual artists. The municipal levels of government have usually not supported individual artists because the Canada Council was there first, because the provincial government has also provided funds for individual artists. But it's the individual artist that actually begins with the imagination, the innovation, and provides really the liveliness that the society needs to stay awake and be aware. So I would like to just echo Joyce in saying that I pay a little tribute to Tom Henry, who has followed me and those who were involved in the reports of 1994 and 2003, because I think it's important to carry things forward. And I've got great confidence that we're moving in the right direction. Never quite fast enough, never quite as ambitiously as everyone would like, but at least we're going in the right direction and doing the right things. So there you go. Thank you.